I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today we are going to have a discussion of the upcoming Scanza Forum on the 2nd of May in Zagreb, Croatia. This is going to be an amazing event. I was absolutely delighted when Frody suggested a debate pairing E. Michael Jones and Jared Taylor. So Frody, how did you come up with this genius plan?
Well, I don't know what to say. I like the idea of debates because the mainstream society doesn't really have debates anymore. People agree about most things. People who are invited to talk on TV and so on, they agree about the fundamentals at least. So I like debates. I find them very interesting myself. One of my favorite debate topics is creationism versus the theory of evolution. There are many funny and fun debates on that topic online. I've read a few of E. Michael Jones's books, and I know that he's very popular on the right. And when I heard interviews with him where he said that race is a fiction, race isn't real, there really is no such thing as white, and that Catholicism is the only cause for the difference between Europe and Africa, I sort of, you know, I want to test that. I want to test that claim. And I don't know, Jared Taylor was the first one who came up in my mind to do that. And even before that, I wanted to create a debate between yourself, Greg, and Alexander Dugin. Because in a debate, I mean, he said this many times, but in a debate between Dugin and Bernard Henry Levy in France, he said that he agrees with Franz Boas' theories about race. And I thought, well, let's debate this. We should debate this. If someone makes claims like that, I want to debate them in public. So that's how I came up with it. And when I contacted E. Michael Jones, he was, I mean, to his credit, he accepted my invitation and wanted to debate it. And at first, he disagreed with the topic because I think my first formulation of the topic was, is race a false concept? And he said that, well, that's open for interpretation, or that's a very vague question. So what I did then was I just went back to the recordings of his interviews, and I just took his own words. And I said, well, you said here that race is a fiction. Would you like to defend that in a debate? So he agreed to debate Jared Taylor on that topic. So I formulated the question, is race an important reality or a fiction? Because I wanted to get away. I mean, I think that a good debate topic has a couple of elements. It makes a very clear distinction. I mean, it's either this or it's that. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for the audience to follow. And also, it excludes my own bias, because I am obviously biased as an organizer, because I do believe that race exists. But to make sure that I can't influence this in any way by sort of hedging my bets and formulating an unfair question, I just wanted to use E. Michael Jones's own words to formulate the debate topic. And the format this is going to have is that first, both of the participants will give their a 20-minute each opening presentation or opening statement, and then they will be given 10 minutes each to respond to each other's statements, and then they will be given 5 minutes each to give a closing statement, and then 20 minutes questions from the audience. So we'll have an hour and a half in total. And I think that just, you know, I take my hands off it, so I can't influence it in any way. So it's these two gentlemen who are battling it out on stage.
Well, I think that's a good approach. I really enjoyed debating Jonas Deger about Christianity and white identity a few years ago in Stockholm. We had a similar setup for that. And I do think that if you take the person's own words, he really can't later say, well, the question was rigged, the topic was slanted. Yeah. So I think that that's a very good way of going about it. So how did you decide on Zagreb as the location?
Well, yeah, that's also another challenge, because another factor why I wanted to invite Jared Taylor is that he was prevented to come to our last meeting. He has spoken at two Scanza forums in Stockholm and in Denmark. And then I invited him a third time to speak for the second time in Stockholm. And he was prevented from entering the country because he was stopped in Switzerland, turned back to the United States because Poland had banned him from traveling in the Schengen area. They wanted to prevent him from spreading, as they themselves said, totalitarian ideologies. And anyone who knows Jared knows, you know, they know how true that is, that he's a very totalitarian guy.
Yeah, he's a jackbooted thug.
Yeah.
Low cranial index, brutish appearance. Yeah, exactly. Speaks in grunts.
Yeah, Cro-Magnon, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's our Jared. Yeah, it's very irritating that so far it's been the based Poles and Hungarians who have been most liberal in handing out Schengen bans on people who are a little more to the right of them.
Yeah, it's like if you have a reputation for being conservative, you want to go the extra mile to be a good boy and get a pat on the back from the establishment because you don't want to be, you know,
one of those racist types.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. The great impediment is the taboo against racism. Mm. And most conservatives are naive enough to think that they can get everything that they want without talking about race. They
yeah.
think, well, we believe in universal principles, one size fits all principles, all humanity wants to be just like Poland or just like the United States. So why can't we just exclude these people and then we won't get any guff from the left-wing press and these advocacy groups? Of course, that never works. Yeah. They're always being accused of being racists anyway. And the reason they're accused of it is because it works. It's a way of manipulating them.
Yeah.
It's just like being in an abusive relationship where your spouse or your significant other is screaming, "You don't love me, you don't care about me," and then you have to placate them because you take these patently false and manipulative accusations seriously and you try and placate them. And you know, they're just the stupid party. The right has not caught on to that particular game, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
I just want to add with Zagreb, Croatia, why, you know, there are other countries in Europe outside of Schengen. But I don't know. Croatia strikes me as a civilized country. You know, it's not too unusual for Westerners to go there. It's
like, yeah.
It's not out of their outside of their comfort zone. And at the same time, it's a vacation destination for many Europeans. Many people like to go there on vacation. And early May will be warm and very pleasant. So, you know, it's an opportunity for people to go there and spend a few days in Croatia. And also it's relatively cheap for Westerners to go there.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I haven't been to Croatia yet. I would like to visit. So this will be my first visit to Croatia.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful country by all accounts. It has beautiful mountains and lakes and waterfalls, and then an amazingly long and beautiful coastline. Lots of interesting buildings dating back from antiquity through the Middle Ages, up into the 19th century and even 20th century. And it is relatively inexpensive. Also, there are a lot of sort of cheap ways of getting to Croatia because it's made tourism one of its major industries.
Yes.
So that's a consideration for people coming, definitely.
Yeah, because I thought that, you know, this is going to be quite spectacular.
Yeah.
And I want to make it possible for people to travel far to come to this thing, make it as easy as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And if they're going to travel a long way, they might want to spend a week there.
Yes.
Make it a little vacation. See Croatia, see Slovenia, see Hungary. All these countries are very close together, easy to travel from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that Tom Sunic, who is a local Croatian, a Croatian native, will be giving an introduction. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, since I decided upon Croatia and Zagreb, and Tom Sunic is an old friend, old acquaintance, and he's spoken at the Skanza Forum before, so I thought it's only natural to invite him to give a welcoming speech. It's going to be a short. He's not going to be on the main card. He's going to give a welcoming speech. It's a place of honor in a way.
Right, right.
And I think that's very suitable. And many people like him. I mean, he's very popular among the audience or the guests who come to the Skanza Forum. A lot of them have requested to hear more from him. And he's written some good books. And, you know, so he's a very popular guy. And if it's his hometown, of course, I'm going to invite him.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. Jared spilled the beans about the location, which I think is very, very entertaining. Yeah, he was on a live stream with Mark Collett and mentioned that it was going to be happening in Zagreb. So who are some of the other speakers at this event? How long will the event be? Can you tell us a little bit about just how it's organized, when it's going to happen, when people might want to arrive, things like that?
Yeah. Well, we're going to start in the early afternoon and continue into the night.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the main event, the main debate, is a total of 1.5 hours. We have breaks in between. We're going to have a lunch break. And the other speeches are about 30 minutes each. And then I like to have Q&As. I like to have questions and answers to have interactions with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the event, I like to put all the speakers on stage and just take general questions from the audience. And that is usually a very popular format because just sitting, listening to speeches all day, it sort of makes you a bit tired. So, if you have a chance to interact, that makes it a bit more lively.
Yeah, I think so. I think the Q&A sessions at the end are a good feature for the Scanza Forum. It's a little more spontaneous and it is more interactive. It's more engaging for the audience. So who all is going to be speaking besides E. Michael Jones and Jared Taylor?
So you, of course, are going to speak, and you have been, I mean, you said at the beginning of this year that you're not going to give any public speeches. So I thought I might as well give you an offer you can't refuse.
Right. Yes. The opportunity to see Jones and Taylor on stage together debating this topic made me break one of my New Year's resolutions. So I got almost a month into the new year before I broke a New Year's resolution. So that's actually pretty good. So, you know, gyms apparently do a booming business in like the first month of every year, and then it drops off precipitously as people start failing to keep their New Year's resolutions. So I'm not alone in that camp, I'm afraid. But yeah, I definitely had to see this. So I thought, well, if I'm going to go there, I might as well say something.
And I don't know how this thing started with E. Michael Jones before we get on to the next speakers, but he said himself in a podcast that he gave a speech at Sam Francis's funeral and people, you know, claiming that race isn't real. And that is one of the starts to you know, this debate between him and others on the right.
Yeah, well, wasn't at Sam Francis's funeral, I believe, although he might have spoken at that event, I don't think so, but he did speak at an event that took place, I think it was in 2007. It was a memorial event in Washington, D.C. It was at the National Press Club for Sam Francis.
Yeah, that might be my mistake. Maybe it wasn't his funeral. It was something to do with Sam Francis anyway.
But yeah, I was at that event. I was not in the room at the time. I was out in the lobby area, networking, basically. And when it was over, I remember I remember Peter Brimlow and Sam Dixon flying out of the room, all agitated about what they had just witnessed from E. Michael Jones. And apparently what Jones had done was he got up and talked about not Sam Francis so much, but he talked about his own particular focus, which is the Jewish question. And apparently, because he went on that topic, which was, I don't believe, the agreed upon topic, the event ended up not being covered by, I think, C-SPAN or one of these other cable-type networks was going to actually broadcast the talks, and they killed it, I believe, because of this. And that created a great deal of anger at Jones. And then the stuff that he simply said during the event, during his talk, well, it was signs of all this stuff about race, basically.
Right.
And he's had a big influence in our circles. He is a very prolific author. I began reading his stuff, gosh, in the 1990s. I read his book, Living Machines. I read his book called Degenerate Moderns and a book called Dionysus Rising. And I thought they were interesting books by a guy who's widely read, but I especially thought that Dionysus Rising was sort of a work of crankery, basically. And I also read, let's see, his book Libido Dominandi, or at least a good chunk of it. It got to be a bit of a slog. And also parts of his book, The Slaughter of Cities, and then parts of his book, The Jewish Revolutionary.
Jewish Revolutionary Spirit.
Yeah, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. So anyway, he's an interesting figure. He's very much focused on Jews, and he's very much focused on Catholicism, and he's very much anti-race.
Yes.
And he's sort of a typical paleocon, and the talking points that you heard him repeating about race is not an important concept, ethnicity is more important than race, these are standard paleocon talking points. You hear them coming out of the mouth of people like Paul Gottfried. You hear them repeated at Chronicles magazine, or at least I did when I looked at that publication. It's an attempt to try and draw a barrier between the paleocons and racial nationalists. Because like Yoram Hazony, like the Polish government, like all these people on the right, they think they can get what they want while maintaining a taboo against race realism that's been set up by the left. Mm-hmm. Basically, they want to be good little boys and color within the lines that have been laid down by their enemies. And they have these talking points, which are, I think, really lame. So, simply very lame. Oh, race doesn't matter, it's ethnicity. Well, it's not that simple. It's not in either or, for one thing. And, of course, they want to argue that some kind of universalistic doctrine, like Christianity, is the way that we can get above racial and ethnic animosities.
And one thing he has said about ethnicity is that it might not, you know, he doesn't mean what we mean by it. He says that ethnicity is only language.
Yeah.
So language, if you use the same language, that's ethnicity. I mean, that's what defines ethnicity. So it's not common ancestry, common genetic belonging and tribe. It's speaking the same language.
Right, right. So that means that Nigerians are Englishmen, basically.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he said these things, and I just find it very interesting. I just want to, you know, he also said that that race is a fiction, and it's not only a fiction, it's a trap that's set by your enemies. And by your enemies, my interpretation, I don't know if he means that, but my interpretation is that he means that Jews have created the concept of race, and that's a trap for us somehow. And I, you know, so that's one of the motivations why I want to invite him. What does he mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think it's important to do this because Jones's influence has been rising recently. And as the alt-right has collapsed and a lot of people have become disaffected, they've been looking around for escape hatches, basically. And when people get red-pilled about race, there's really no going back from it. So they have to, instead of retreating from race realism, they have to figure out some way of going meta and declaring from some lofty Olympian perch that this doesn't really matter. And the way that they do that, the preferred way in these rightist circles, is to go Christian,
right?
Basically, because Christianity is some meta level thing where they can comment about how pitifully limited our understanding is down on the swamplands of materialism or whatever. And I think a lot of it's insincere, frankly. They want a rightist perspective that's sort of ready-made, that's not racist, that allows them to trot out all of their reactionary fixations while not violating the race taboo.
Right.
The thing is that a taboo that you don't violate is still a taboo.
You reinforce it.
You reinforce it
by actively not violating it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you actively, it's like some of these people, you know, for example, well, these sort of more or less Sivnat groups. I mean, the identitarians are one example. They sort of want to distance themselves from if some member violates this taboo or something. So they're very active in patrolling this taboo. And so they reinforce it, and therefore that's why it's not a wise tactical move to do that.
They reinforce the enemy message.
The thing you have to do with taboos, you have to violate them.
You have to break them, or they're still in power.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't ignore them. because if you ignore them, that means you're afraid of them.
Yeah.
And they're still in power.
Yeah.
You've got to break them.
Yeah. Another thing that he said, another statement that he made, was that he has high hopes for the Mexican immigration because most Mexicans are Catholics. And
well, there you go.
Yeah.
The know-nothings in the 19th century in America, the anti-Catholic bigots, they weren't entirely wrong. There was a great conflict between Protestantism and Catholicism, you know, centuries basically of warfare, beginning with the Reformation. And the nationalist position was highly identified with Protestantism.
Sure.
And they looked upon the Catholic Church as a globalist, imperialist, anti-nationalist force.
Yeah.
That was hell-bent on undermining the national integrity of any Protestant country. And they thought that Catholicism was a kind of Trojan horse to the South, basically, that would open the gates to the South, for one thing. And they're absolutely correct about that. There is something about this. The Catholic Church looks to Latin America as one of its strongest places. And of course, if the church wants to strengthen itself in the United States, it's going to welcome non-whites from Latin America. It'll also welcome non-whites from Africa, too. One of the things that makes me laugh are these ultra-conservative Catholics who think that what'll save the church is a black pope. Because the blacks in Africa, the black Catholics, the based black men, you know, they'll give them a great big red pope hat, right? The based Africans are so conservative about all the social issues that reactionary Catholics love. And so they're praying for a based black African cardinal to become pope.
Yeah.
And I'm praying for that day to come, too, because I think that at that point, it would be impossible for people who were trying to straddle the race realist Catholic thing to keep doing that. They're going to have to choose, finally, once there's a black pope in Rome. And eventually there will be a black pope in Rome, although it's very, very strongly Italian, the papacy.
Right.
Most popes have been Italian because it's the Roman Catholic Church. And even the present pope is ethnically Italian from South America.
Right. Yeah, this is a very fascinating topic because isn't it also true that John F. Kennedy, the first Catholic president of America, was one of the people, he and his brother, who pushed the 1965 immigration reform?
Well, JFK was dead by then.
But yeah,
his brother, yeah.
Yeah, but he was also pro that. It was enacted after his death.
Yeah.
But he and the Catholics were pushing that change, were part of lobbying for that change to happen in the immigration reform.
Yeah, Catholicism is a somewhat more globalist form of Christianity than Protestantism, just for historical reasons. Protestants had to fight for basically places where they could be free to practice their religion away from the claims of the papacy to stand above politics and dictate to the whole political realm. And so the end of the wars of the Reformation, well, basically the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648 wasn't the last war of the Reformation, of course, but it was the end of the 30 Years' War, which is the biggest Reformation-related conflict, basically established the idea of modern sovereign states as opposed to the notion of Christendom.
Right.
This sort of quasi-imperial idea that the church could stand above the political realm and dictate to the political realm. And of course, there had been struggles over this in the Middle Ages as well.
Yeah, that's interesting when you debate, when you discuss with Catholics, is that many people will always, is like the go-to explanation is that it's all Second Vatican Council. It's all Vatican II in the 1960s.
Right.
But my opinion or my interpretation of Catholicism is more in line with Jones. I mean, I think his talking points are consistent with Catholic teachings. And this didn't happen, you know, this rejection of race and, you know, the concept of white people and so on. That didn't come with the Second Vatican Council. The Vatican was hostile to Hitler's Germany, and they wrote this statement, encyclica, Mit Brennen der Sorge in 1937, mm-hmm. because Germany was racist, and that's against Catholic faith. So this is an old thing.
They also affirm that Catholics and Christians are all spiritual Jews or something to that effect, or that they have a spiritual connection with Jews. And that was, of course, one of the reasons why the National Socialists were bad people. Yeah, it goes way, way back, because Christianity is a universalistic doctrine. And within the eyes of the church and in the eyes of God, they claim, racial differences and ethnic differences don't really matter.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, some people have commented that this is infighting or something like that. But it isn't. This is clarifying intellectual points. This is clarifying ideology. This is a lack of debate leads only to intellectual deterioration. We need to debate central issues. And when people make claims about something, that needs to be debated.
Right. Well, we weren't the ones making claims that race is a fiction.
Right, right.
Jones was making that claim. He started it, and we just want to discuss this, and we can discuss it in an adult fashion, because this is a grown-up movement, or at least good chunks of it are grown-up, and we can have civilized debate about these issues.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that Jones is a problem because he helps rationalize what I think is a retreat from the race front by certain people in the movement. They just want to step aside from that. They're talking about how white nationalism is a toxic idea, and they want to step back to a position where they can say that, well, race is beside the point, or it's a thing, but it's not an important thing, or whatever. So I do think that Catholicism is a kind of escape hatch that people are using. I think a lot of it's disingenuous. But the trouble is that when you try and be a disingenuous Christian, you end up being called on it again and again. For instance, I never believed that Matt Parrott was a sincere Christian in any form or another. I always thought that he was just pretending. And yet, I remember him a few years ago stating that he would rather see the whole white race perish than to legalize abortion or put up with legalized abortion. It's like, well, who fooled whom in the end?
Mm.
Yeah, if he thought that he was running a really clever operation by declaring himself, first it was a Mormon, I think, and then it was an Orthodox Christian, and thinking that he could perform some kind of entryism into these institutions and repurpose them for his aims. Well, to do that, he's got to echo their views. And their views are very, very bad for white people. And so in the end, one ends up fooling oneself. And really, white people are the only people who are fooled by these clever tactics. And eventually, the people who take this position as sort of an entryist thing, or a kind of blind, or a kind of pose, or whatever, they end up believing it, or they drop it.
Right.
And if you actually look at the history of the church, you look at somebody like Pascal. Pascal says it's easier to believe, it's easier to act yourself into believing than to believe yourself into acting.
Right.
Which means that the people who don't believe but go along publicly, exoterically, with the church will end up believing it.
Yes.
In the end. And so the church wants you to deceive them. They love it when people think, okay, I'm going to deceive these people by going along with them and not upsetting them publicly, paying lip service to their dogmas. If you do that, they've got you.
It's sort of like, if you go to any modern Western university, they'll have gender questions on tests.
Yeah.
And probably, I mean, that's my impression from just talking to people at university and so on. Probably a lot of them, probably the majority of people answering those questions will give the answer that's expected of them that they don't really believe themselves. But the thing is that if you repeatedly give that answer that's expected of you, you say, well, you pay lip service to it, that will end up influencing how you actually think.
Exactly.
It works.
Yeah.
You'll brainwash yourself through your own actions.
They achieve two things when they get you to quote-unquote fool them.
Yeah.
One, you don't challenge their dogmas and taboos. And two, you subtly undermine your own beliefs and make it more likely that eventually you're going to go along with their dogmas anyway. This is why this whole notion of esotericism in relation to religion is very, very problematic. You read somebody like Leo Strauss, who talks about the history of philosophy, basically, and argues that there's a tradition in philosophy where philosophers, because they lived in repressive societies, and usually the repressive dogmas were religions, would outwardly go along with the dominant religion while maintaining their own philosophical beliefs in private.
Right.
So if you pretend that you're a Muslim in a Muslim country, well, then you won't be persecuted, but that you can be a Neoplatonist in the privacy of your own thoughts, something like that. Well, when ideas like that are put out today, post-liberalism, and one of the things that liberalism has done is created religious tolerance in the West. You know, we're not in any danger of being killed by the Catholic Church for our views now, or the Protestant Church for our views now. So in that context, there's really no need for religious esotericism.
Right.
However, this idea is brought out, and clever people, clever intellectuals think, well, why not practice esotericism today? If you practice esotericism today in a context where society has basically become secularized and religion doesn't have the power to persecute you, that's exactly what the churches want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
They've lost all secular power. They're declining. And the only thing that they can really do to hold on is persuade clever people that they're getting they're getting one over on the church by not being openly opposed to the church.
Right.
Then what you do is you maintain that what the church would prefer as a structure of taboos.
Yeah.
And if you pretend long enough, you'll start believing it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think that in the modern context, esotericism vis-a-vis religion is something that the religions want you to engage in. They want you to try and fool them because they know in the end you're going to fool your neighbors and you're going to fool yourself, and they're going to cling to life by doing that, because that's the only power that they have now. They can't compel you to go along with their dogmas, but they can trick you into thinking that it's the clever politic thing to do, to go along with their dogmas. So I really, really question the function of esotericism in modernity, because I do think that the only people who actually benefit from that are the religions that no longer have the power to persecute.
Yeah, I mean, I have never been secretive about my views on Christianity or on race, so obviously I'm not impartial in this debate. But I have to say, you know, I want to give E. Michael Jones credit for accepting the invitation and doing the debate.
Well, he believes what he says.
He believes what he says, and that's to his credit, because he's not a bullshitter. A lot of people say these things, and they actually believe in modern science, they actually believe in evolution, they actually believe in race. And it's like, he's just very consistent with Catholic teachings, and that's what makes for an interesting debate. You know,
yeah,
when you have fundamental disagreement, and that's why I like it. And I have to say that the reactions have been overwhelming. People are, you know, fighting in the comments. People are seriously passionate about this debate. You know, like hundreds and hundreds of comments and thousands of comments. People are very, you know, taking sides in this.
Yeah, that's great. The debate has already begun.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about a couple of the other speakers at the yes. event, and then we can talk about how you promoted it and the reactions you've gotten to it, and sure. then you can give people contact info and stuff like that so they sure. can sign up.
Sure. Yes. Like I said, yourself, you're going to speak, and you've actually been scheduled to speak at every Scansla forum, but you were prevented the two last times.
Yeah. let's hope I can break that cycle.
Yeah. Ed Dutton is speaking at the Scansla forum for the second time. He spoke in Oslo as well. That was a very popular speech, and he's an excellent speaker. He's a funny speaker. Mm-hmm. He's an entertainer. He's an actor. He acts on stage. It's sort of like a play in a way, as he does on his YouTube channel, The Jolly Heretic. So that just continues onto stage, and I've repeated that many times, that it's sort of like a British tradition of oratory, mm-hmm. like this showmanship, and it's very entertaining. He's very popular. And then we have Millennial Bose, who is back for the, I don't know, maybe this is the fifth time or sixth time. He's spoken at many Scansla forums. And he's always a popular speaker. Mm-hmm. He's a very good speaker. And lately he has crafted some very philosophical speeches. Mm-hmm. In September on the Patriotic Alternative Conference, he gave a speech on evil, the concept of evil, the philosophical concept of evil. And that was actually a very good speech, and many people said that that was the best speech they've heard from him, because, you know, he suggested in that speech that what happens in the modern world, like policemen turning a blind eye to the kids being raped and in Rotherham, that can only be explained as evil, mm-hmm. in a way. And when he gave the first speech at the Scansla Forum, his first speech at the Scansla Forum in Oslo, summer of 2017, many people said that this is the kind of speech that I would give to my quote-unquote normie friends to sort of introduce them to our topics. Mm-hmm. So I think he sort of bridges a gap on that front. So he's a very good speaker, so I'm looking forward to him. And then myself, I will actually deliver a speech on race, the question of, is race a social construct? Mm-hmm. And I was going to speak about that in Oslo, but for reasons that are external to my own control, things that happened, I didn't really have time to deliver my own speech at that event because things were quite chaotic. It was a successful event in many ways. It got more attention than any event of ours has done before, but I wasn't able to deliver that speech. And it's a speech that I have great confidence in. So I will look forward to giving that speech. So that's going to be fun.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very good lineup. So I'm definitely looking forward to being there. So how did you promote this, and what kind of reaction have you gotten?
Yeah, I made a promo video when I announced the event, before I announced that we're going to be in Zagreb. So I made a promo video, a 2-minute video, posted it on Twitter. It has upward of 25,000 views or something, 23,000 views, and plus, you know, all the views on YouTube. So many people have shared this, and we posted an announcement on Countercurrents and on Amren. And the comments just keep coming in, because both of them have very passionate followers. And a lot of Catholics are sort of just, they're really sort of, they're fighting, fighting for their guy in the comments. Mm-hmm. And not everyone actually knew about this disagreement on the topic. So it was new to them. And, you know, it's just the interest has been overwhelming in many ways. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of fun, because that's why I like organizing events, because it sort of gets people out of the internet as well. You know, mm-hmm. it gets people excited, and then they come to an event and they can network and socialize. And that's the main purpose, really.
Yeah. 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 I've always viewed these meetings as being useful in and of themselves for the ideas that are put out there. But the ideas can be put out there on the internet.
Yes.
They don't need to be put out in a room full of people.
Right.
The reason to do it with a room full of people is the IRL networking opportunities and the community that it provides, which are important as well.
Yeah. You know, some people have commented, why not just do this debate online? We could just do it online. Well, I don't think so. I think it's better to actually get these people to Europe, because we are, you know, the Scansa Forum is in Europe.
Yeah.
So let's have an event. Let's actually get people together, because there's this cliche that you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Like, it's like a business wisdom. If you hang out with successful people, you will become successful. And if we actually create events, we want to attract high quality people. We want to get people to travel far to participate in the event. So it actually takes some sacrifice that will self-select for good people in the end. Mm-hmm. And already, I mean, we already have social circles of friends and business ideas and all kinds of things that are formed around these events. That people who have met at the event and they have formed friendships or formed business relations and created projects together. And that's how things work. Because, yeah, you can talk to someone online, but you really have to meet them face to face to get the right kind of confidence in them to create a substantial project together.
Yeah, that's true. The people who run the world meet face to face.
Yes.
They want us to be isolated in our little cubicles and pods, consuming information off the internet and never meeting other people. But they meet face to face.
Sure.
And we need to do the same.
And actually, the people who complain about that, I mean, they should take it as a hint, because that's not the kind of people I want there. Right. We don't want just any ragtag people there. We want people who are dedicated and actually want to change things to come to these events.
Right.
Because I want people with potential. Because this isn't just entertainment. This is a step in a plan to actually change society.
Yeah.
And it's like when people complain about, you know, they have to travel to do this. They have to. Some people travel from America or even Asia to come to Scandinavia to go to my conferences. Some people can't bother to take the bus 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a good thing, because that selects for the most dedicated people who actually have potential to change things.
Right.
And it, like I said to a friend, you know, we were talking about the possibility of making a live stream out of this, you know, mm-hmm. a sort of a pay-per-view live stream, make it professional.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, well, you know, if the UFC or some sort of sports event is more successful than we are able to be, and we want to change the world, then we've sort of already lost, haven't we? you know, if people care more about sports events and just pure entertainment, and we actually want to change things, then we have to rethink how we do things, I think.
Well, the things that we do are never going to be as popular as sports.
No. But it's a way of seeing it. It's a way of what amount of dedication are you prepared to devote to do this?
Right. There are some unflattering comparisons that we can use for our movement. I mean, sports and entertainment is always going to be more popular than politics and philosophy, even though politics and philosophy are more important in the greater scheme of things. But when you look at things like fan conventions and stuff like that, you know, or fan culture and things like that, again, that's just entertainment. But the level of organization and dedication that these people have to their little fan cultures is kind of amazing. A better, more political analogy would be the animal rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
When there are as many people who are willing to dedicate themselves to saving the white race as there are who are dedicated to stopping fur coats and factory farms and things like that, I'm not going to have any fear for our future.
Right.
And we're getting there.
Yeah.
But we do need to demand more from people. That's one of the lessons that Douglas Hyde's book, Dedication Leadership, taught. If you want dedicated people, you have to demand more from them.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to, you know, I want to raise the bar.
Yeah.
I don't, for some things, I want to raise the bar. and make it more difficult to participate.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to have an event on the top of a mountain, so you have to climb it first.
Right.
To get people who actually are worth something.
On the slopes of Vesuvius.
On the slopes of Vesuvius, yeah.
Yes.
Place your conferences on the slopes of Vesuvius.
Yeah, but by the same token, we can also make all the videos available for free online.
Exactly, yeah.
So we can do both.
Yes, we can. No, but I mean, that's the point, though, that these people who complain and who are backseat drivers and complain about these things because, would I have to fly over there? And like you said, it's going to be put online. Well, those are the people I don't want. I don't want anything to do with them because, you know, really, because, you know, the people who just complain, they will not contribute.
Right.
They will not contribute to our success, to our general success. So yeah, I want to select.
Yeah. People. And for people who are living in Europe, it's quite cheap to get to Croatia.
Yes.
There are lots of budget airlines in Europe and cheap bus lines and trains. If you're in Central or Eastern Europe, it's quite inexpensive. It's quite reasonable. We're not trying to put great barriers up. Is the cost of the event going to be similar to the ones in Scandinavia, or will it be a little less? How are you pricing it?
Yeah, I want to keep prices down because it's a country that's not as rich as Scandinavia, for example.
Right.
But at the same time, we have to break even, and that's why we have this fundraiser, because the events never break even without donations.
Right.
I mean, this is the, I haven't counted, but I think the 9th Scanza Forum.
Wow.
So far. I mean, yeah, we've been busy.
Yeah.
3 last year. So this is the 8th or 9th Scanza Forum, and not one single Scanza Forum before has broken even financially without donations. So the ticket sales don't cover all the costs, all the expenses. So we've always have to ask our supporters for you know, support to cover the last expenses. And so that's why we have this fundraiser beforehand.
Because about the fundraiser then.
Sure. So we started this fundraiser just because we need a budget. We don't do magic. So we can't create things without a budget. So we need that. And just to keep ticket prices down, because if we were to have the prices where they need to be to cover all the costs, that would be unreasonable for Croatians.
Right.
Or for college students.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why we have this. And, you know, like I've said, that organizations like the ADL or the SPLC, they have a yearly budget of $50-60 million to try to shut us up and shut us down and silence us. And we're always struggling. So that will have predictable results. We have to become more professional if we actually mean business with this. If we actually are serious about what we want to do. So we started this fundraiser, and you can contribute with credit card or crypto, or you can send me, and all that information is on Countercurrent, so in the links. And you can send me an email if you want to contribute in some other way.
Great.
And there's one thing, you know, that actually sort of stuck in my memory in the early days of Countercurrents. And that is when I listened to one of the early Countercurrents radio. I think this was with Mike Polignano. And this was when Countercurrents had just been going for like a few months.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that because you guys had a fundraiser, or you were opening for donations, and you had already been, you know, taking donations for like a couple of months at least. And he said, well, don't think that you know, someone else is gonna do it.
Right.
Don't just sit there and expect that, yeah, maybe I'll chip in later. Someone else is doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it will be taken care of even without my help.
Right.
And I heard that and I thought, yeah, you know, I was a student, university student. And I thought, yeah, you know, I signed up for a monthly donation.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys sent me an email. And apparently I was the first guy to sign up, although it had been going for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just expected that, you know, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have already signed up.
Right.
And that sort of, that stuck in my memory because, you know, it's like you think that car accidents is just something that happens to someone else.
Yeah.
It never happens to yourself.
Yeah.
Like cancer, whatever. And it's the same thing with donations or fundraisers.
Yeah.
That you think that, well, everyone else is going to chip in and
right.
It'll be all be fine without me. But actually, everyone matters.
Right.
So all contributions matter. And if you can contribute $10 or $20, so, you know, some people can afford 50, 100. But if you can afford $10, send $10 because right. it really helps.
Yeah, definitely. So you are going to be doing some other talks and travels in the near future. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, or is that sort of secret right now?
It's not secret. I will be giving, not all of them are secret anyway.
Okay.
I will be giving a talk in Vilnius on the 15th of February at a conference organized by, I don't remember the name of the group because it's in Lithuanian. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure that would be a great conference. And then there's this Independence Day march that they have the day after,
mm-hmm.
a torch march with lots and lots of nationalists. And I will be talking about Might is Right, Ragnar Redbeard.
Well, you do have that red beard.
I do, yes. Yes. That's why I like the book. I'll be talking about the philosophical implications of Might is Right.
Well, that's great.
It's a classic.
I was at the Vilnius event last year at their little conference, and I also took part in the Torchlight March.
Yeah.
Jared Taylor was there, and we marched together.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful event.
Yeah.
Lithuania is a beautiful place. Lithuanians are really nice people.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite impressive. And then you're going off to Tallinn.
Yes, and then I'm going off to Tallinn. And that is the weekend after. I think this is on the 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
I will be giving a speech in Tallinn, also in connection to their Independence Day. And we were there last year, both of us.
Yeah.
And that was a fantastic event. And it's, you know, it's night and day. It's a different world. Because it's their mainstream people organizing these events, having
yeah.
us as speakers.
Yeah,
it's actually like, you know, their leadership in the country organizing these events.
Yeah, Estonia is a place where my friends and your friends are also in the parliament.
Yes, they are. And you know, when we went there last year, I think the Torch March had 8,000 people.
It was huge.
It was enormous.
It was beautiful. Just a sea of torches.
Yeah.
People of all ages.
Yeah.
There were a few sad-looking, confused people standing off on the side protesting.
Costumes.
Yeah, in costumes. Costume clowns.
And one of the memorable things about this march is that there was an event more than half a century ago when Europe united to fight communism.
Right.
And all the member states in this unit that fought communism, they had their own versions of battle songs.
Yeah.
And they were singing those songs in this march, which is mainstream.
Yeah.
And that was quite impressive.
Yeah. When I went to a Intermarium conference in Kiev in 2018, I was really impressed with what was possible in Kiev because There were people from Azov and National Corps, which are considered to be far, far to the right and totally inappropriate
right.
in the West.
Yes.
And yet there were Polish academicians mm-hmm. from accredited institutions sharing the platform and speaking at an event sponsored by the National Corps, by Azov, by people affiliated with them. And I thought, this is interesting. This is what's possible in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Similarly, you find that in Estonia.
And it's just across the pond from Sweden.
Yeah.
You know, it's just across the Baltic Sea. It's very close. And still, they have members of parliament speaking at these events where we are invited as speakers.
Yeah.
And that's very impressive.
Yeah.
And it's a very... these countries are very beautiful. They are ethnically homogeneous, very peaceful, and it's very pleasant to travel there.
Yeah.
So they have a good thing going, and I really enjoy going there.
Yeah. The biggest problem that Lithuanians have ethnically is Poles. Right. It's like, geez, that sounds like paradise to me. Yeah. Where and there were Polish ethnicity Lithuanians at the Torchlight March too.
Yes.
So in Estonia, their biggest minority are Russians.
Right.
And we would be so lucky in America if our biggest alien group were Russians.
Yes.
We would be in wonderful situation there, obviously.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, it reminds me of the 90s in Sweden when a huge portion of the immigrants that were sort of a problem, they were Southern Europeans.
Yeah.
They were like from Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And like a Greek would be considered like Sweden was, of course, Swedes are Nordics.
Yeah.
So they're not Southern European. There is a visible difference. And Sweden is a very ethnically homogeneous country. But those were the biggest differences we had to deal with in the 90s.
Yeah.
Most of the time, of course, there were some Arabs here and there, but not nearly to the extent that it is now.
Right.
So now, like in the late 90s and in the 2000s, that has changed to the Middle East and to Africa, Somalia.
Right.
That's just how much things have changed lately.
Yeah. One last thing. The last couple of Scanza forums have been beset with Antifa.
Right.
Do you expect any similar problems in Croatia?
Not really, no. I think Eastern Europe, if we can call it Eastern Europe, I guess we can. It's part of ex-communist Europe anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think they have those problems to the same extent. And we will take precautions to prevent anything bad from happening. But no, I don't think they have nearly the situation that Scandinavia has.
Yeah.
With Antifa. The Antifa popped up on the map in the United States just a few years ago, really.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of attacking people and so that has been a very old phenomenon in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it existed in Europe for decades before it came to America.
Mm-hmm.
And now it sort of more or less has disappeared. I mean, sure, we had this stuff that was happening in connection to the Scanza forums in Copenhagen and Oslo, but it's not nearly what it was 10 years ago.
Right.
Or 20 years ago in the 90s. Then it was like a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
So while it sort of, the problem grew in America, it's sort of all diminished in North Europe. And I don't really think that Croatia has that problem to the same extent.
My feeling is that in the Balkans and Central Europe, in the former communist countries, it's the Antifa who live in fear.
Yes, they are not the sort of secret agents of the ruling powers.
Right.
They actually are to a large extent in Sweden and Norway.
Yeah.
And Denmark. They are, it's the spoiled brat kids of the people who are the editors of the big newspapers and the people in the parliament. So it's like a bourgeois fun and games for these kids to go out and attack people, and they have mommy and daddy backing them up.
Yeah.
With psychological warfare in the news media and so on.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the same thing in Croatia.
Right. Well, they certainly weren't much of a presence in Tallinn.
Definitely not. And not in Ukraine either.
Yeah, definitely not in Ukraine. Well, I think this has been very, very good. We've been going for about an hour, so let's wrap up here. I urge everyone who's listening to come to the Scanza Forum in Zagreb. If you can't come, watch it online. But don't be a free rider. Be a donor. Make these things possible by helping out. Last year, Countercurrents had nearly 2 million unique visitors, and we had about 500 people who actually made donations to keep the whole thing going. That's just the pattern. You should be one of those engaged people who actually help out. Go to the show notes, scroll down on the page. You'll see instructions on how to donate to the Scanza Forum. So, Frody, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, no. I want to express my appreciation, of course. You have supported the Scanza Forum and you've spoken since the beginning. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate Countercurrents. So So thank you guys for listening, and I hope to see you all in Zagreb on the 2nd of May.
Thank you.